You're listening to Dig Deep on KEXE, KBXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Joining me in the studio, Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator. His blog is Minnesota Brown. And from Strongtown, CEO and founder Chuck Maroney is our conservative commentator. And we're continuing this conversation about the retail crisis in northern Minnesota. We started talking about Herberger's, and I think we should start, Aaron, you had a really interesting blog post about the difference between a change in, say, workers in an iron mine and workers at Herberger's.
Yeah, I actually started a column that just ran in the Hibbing Daily Tribune here in May. The column began with a fictional news flash declaring that a Iron Range taconite mine was closing, laying off 500 workers, making it kind of look like a real news item without any specific names. I knew that that would get people's attention, and it sure did. A lot of people stopped reading at that point and apparently proceeded to freak out. But what the next sentences in the thing said was
hashtag fake news.
Hashtag fake news. But it was, you know, it was an attention getting device. Was talking about how, if you think about it, because in our last episode we talked about Herberger's closing in Brainerd and Virginia and other places, and the Penny's closing in Hibbing, and really, if you add them with all of the retail stores that have closed, Vanity has had trouble. Different stores, chain stores have closed in our region over, let's say, the last 10 years, not even counting the countless stores that had closed prior to that. Whether they're in malls, standalone stores, how many of them closed? Well, you're not talking about 500 workers. You're talking about thousands of workers, especially on a regional level. But even in a town like Hibbing, if you add up the retail job losses, you're probably looking at hundreds of workers, not unlike a taconite plant that would have closed. The key difference being, and that's quickly pointed out, is that, oh, well, those are just part-time throwaway jobs. Those aren't real taconite jobs with benefits. But for a lot of people, they were real jobs. They were their only job in some cases. In a lot of cases, it was a very important part of a household income. In a lot of cases, it was a part-time work for a young person going to college, and that was a method of paying for college or paying for an apartment while you were going to school, whatever the case may be. That part of the economy simply goes away because we're watching as trends change again, and they're moving now away from the malls and even the box stores, and they're moving to online delivery services like Amazon, and even Walmart and Target, the existing big box giants, are exploring ways that they too will have to make this leap into online market for the for consumer goods. Well, there are jobs associated with that outfit as well. The problem that I point out in the column is that for rural places, rural Minnesota, that's not a good trade because the Amazon warehouses will not be located in Grand Rapids or Hibbing or even Brainerd or even Duluth. There might be some in the Twin Cities, and the big ones, the headquarters, won't even go there. They'll go to the even larger metropolitan areas, and they can bring thousands of jobs into those already diverse economic environments. For Hibbing, for Brainerd, the equation is a loss. And it's an economic loss. It's a loss to income for people who live in the community. In many cases, people who don't always have the option to just flit about the landscape looking for work. These are people who are, you know, maybe caring for children or an aging parent. These are people kind of baked into our population. They don't want to leave necessarily. And so it becomes a major economic problem for our small towns. And it's an employment.
I feel like there's a left-of-center critique of corporate America, and there's a right-of-center critique of centralized government that kind of intersect here in a way. Because what we have done at a national level, really post-World War II, is we've had this slow kind of march in the guise of these macroeconomic theories on efficiency, this march towards a centralization. And the net impact of that centralization is that these communities on the margins, and I think particularly rural areas, small towns, we have become places where capital flows through very quickly. Capital comes in, whether it is in the form of tourists visiting town or transfer payments from governments or people who sell things outside of the community. But the trickle of capital coming in has slowly gone down. But more importantly, the capital leaves the community as quickly as it comes in. Comes in, we go to Walmart, that money goes out, leaves the community. We come in, we go to Herberger's, that money leaves the community. Comes in, we buy something from Amazon, that money leaves the community. And I get that economic model, but I think it's important to contrast that with the older economic model we had, which really was one of essentially a cactus in a desert. Like, how do we leak as least amount of water as we can? How do we leak as least amount of capital as we can? And it's not like we intentionally set this up. This was the way cities had evolved for thousands of years to kind of be these ecosystems locally that kept capital in the community and moved it around. When we get to the workers in that system, Aaron mentioned in the first segment that today clothing costs less of a family budget. Very true. Food costs less of a family budget. Very true. Those things, when we look at them, have a broad range of day-to-day shifts that you can do. One day you can decide to eat hot dogs. The next day you can decide to eat filet mignon. You have the ability to kind of adjust your consumptive patterns kind of on the fly based on, I just lost my job, or I just got 10 hours less a week, or what have you, or I just got a bonus from work. When we look at this shift, now we have shifted where families are spending more on housing. And housing have these long-term fixed costs. If you buy a house, you don't get to lower your payment next month or 6 months from now or 2 years from now because your spouse lost their job. You don't get to change your consumptive patterns with your home. The taxes for the local government goes up, 20% next year. You don't get to adapt the way you do things. A lot of people are forced into renting because of this. And what we see with renting is that renting has the same kind of volatility. Prices continue to go up. You don't get to adjust your consumptive patterns over time. And so what we have done, and this is all kind of coming back to this theme of making things more efficient at the cost of making things more fragile or less stable at the local level, we've actually tried to give people more, and in the process, given them a lot fewer choices, a lot less flexibility, and a lot more instability. And I think that this is some of the essential consternation that families feel today. Herberger's, and I don't know if you knew this, I found this out after it closed. When Bon-Ton bought Herberger's, they bought out an employee-owned company. So the employees of Herberger's, and there was actually a point in time where the management of Herberger's were afraid that their employees were getting too kind of fat and lazy because they were making a lot of money because the profits for Herberger's went to the actual employees. And you had people who had six-figure, seven-figure nest eggs from having a career at Herberger's doing essentially retail or light management kind of work. That's all gone now. Nobody at Herberger's today has got a six-figure nest egg from working at Herberger's. That model has disappeared, is gone, mm-hmm. and was sucked up into this Bon-Ton debt monster. We have robbed our communities of the ability and our families of the ability to build wealth for themselves. And we've done it with the best of intentions. We want to make things efficient and lower prices and lower mm-hmm. costs. The net result has not been good for families. It's not been good for small business. It's not been good for our communities.
The term shedding legacy cost is a big thing in corporate America, and it was a big part of what happened in the mining industry and a lot of the big manufacturing industries as well. And the idea that workers had accomplished something, some sort of achievement of balance with the market, and that was benefiting the middle class. It was allowing families to socially move upward in the economy. And really starting in the 80s and 90s until now, we've watched as those families who have, whatever they had achieved, now find, that getting that same benefit is not possible because the companies have sought through consolidation and mergers and different bankruptcies and different techniques to shed legacy cost. And you can say, well, too bad for them, they'll have to find another job. And that's I think where we're at here is the big problem is everybody's hiring right now. There's, in a lot of ways, we talk about a workforce crisis coming in America where we're worried about not having enough workers. But what the problem is at least half of those 46 to, I've seen 40s and 50% of those jobs that the companies are so hungry to put people in are not adequate to pay for the housing Chuck just talked about. You know, I remember when we bought our first house, we used a first-time homebuyers program through the AEOA, Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency in St. Louis County. And we had to take classes about good decisions when you took out your mortgage and how to service your loan and all this. And they had, you know, percentages. You're not supposed to exceed this amount of income or of spending on your housing if you want to live a stable a lifestyle. And I remember we bought our first house and we hit that number, maybe even a little under that number. We were doing pretty good. But it's kind of like the speed limit on a backcountry road now when you talk about what that number is. Almost nobody follows it anymore because we've tested and our economy now really wants you. We want these big houses. Look at our culture. Look at the shows on HGTV. You know, that we joke about them. You know, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a circus freak, and my wife makes envelopes, artisanal envelopes, and our budget is $2.5 million. You know, and we make jokes about these things, but this is kind of what we're in right now. People are saddling themselves 60-70% of their income going towards housing, either rent or a mortgage, and they've got to then work to get enough money to do that. And we're finding as the jobs that could possibly pay the freight on these expensive housing costs are going away. And there are other jobs that pay well, highly educated jobs, technical jobs. Trades are really underrepresented right now. They need people in the trades. You know, I work at Hibbing Community College. We have programs that we know. We can walk you right out the door on graduation day. You can take off your robe and put on whatever you need to wear for work the next day, and these are enrollments down. You know, we're trying to get people to do it either because of the cost of college or other concerns. We aren't able to quite make that leap yet. So I think we're at this point where this super efficient system, Chuck was talking about the efficiency of all of it, is encountering inefficient parts of life, which are human behavior, which is very inefficient.
Messy, chaotic, right.
Because it's affected, governed by emotions and tradition and other things.
Let me give you the economic terms. Economists assume the rational man, right? And I say that in a gender neutral way, that their model assumes that humans are rational. And look around this table. I mean, humans are vastly irrational. We do ridiculous things all the time.
Yeah, like order shirts that cost $50 online, right?
Or drive hours to be on a radio show, you know, just because they enjoy doing it. Yeah, I mean, seriously, the models assume that. And so they don't work.
Right. Yeah, and so we're in this great change right now. And it's happening in our industries, but it's been happening on our main streets. And I think at their heart, people know that there are these big changes coming, but there's a lot of anxiety and fear and plain confusion about what to do about it. You know, we see the store close at the mall and we are upset, and we knew someone who worked there, and maybe we should buy local or what should we do? And the reality is, when you say buy local, you know, the damage has been done in some of these small towns to the point where buy local, go to the Dollar General, you know, and buy some Tic Tacs and Doritos. You know, what do we do to capture what's been done?
It's a local Dollar General.
It's a local Dollar General. Dollar General.
Yeah. No, it's true.
I think Dollar General is a really interesting economic, because they're owned locally, I think, right? And I didn't really realize until one was put in Reamer, where my mother-in-law lives, and she should not be driving to Grand Rapids to go to Walmart. It's a mini Walmart for her.
Yeah, it is. It's a small...
For elderly people, it is in rural areas, it's adds so much to her life, and she's at her own home longer because
and Dollar General, more than Amazon, is the number one competitor of Walmart. I think it's interesting for me to step back and look at the response to this set of crises, Because on the left, the thing that I hear from the political left is we need higher minimum wages. We need universal basic income. We need universal health care. We need essentially all these centralized dictums and systems to kind of alleviate the stresses that we see. I see from the conservative right in this country basically a failure to kind of acknowledge those things, or the way you deal with them is to say, well, let's just make things more efficient. Let's just centralize more of the economy. Let's just give corporations like more tax breaks and make them, you know, mm-hmm. give the ability to drive down prices of housing yeah. even more and drive down prices of food even more. I think the reason why those narratives fall short is they're not really recognizing the problem. The problem is at the local level, our systems are not very dynamic. They're not able to really change and adapt. They're only able to succeed or fail. And we've really gotten to the point where living in a community is a pass-fail experience. And you see more and more people are falling on the fail side of that. And it's not really because they're, let me say that again. It's not because they're deficient people in any way. It's not because like they're incapable of surviving in society. If we went back 100 years, some of them might be on the margins of society, but it's not like they would fail. What we've just done is we've created a system where you have to be either one, very, you know, wealthy or affluent, or, you know, have a professional job and a professional career path, be tied into a government job or a government, you know, position to have stability. Or you're going to be subjected to kind of these crazy outside forces that you have no ability to really do anything about. To me, that's a source of immense stress. When I look around at my family, when I look around at my neighbors and my community, whether you're political left or political right, or whether you don't really care about any of it, there's a certain level of economic anxiety with the notion that it's really hard to get a start. It's really hard to start with nothing and end up with something. And there's a fear of losing the little bit that you actually have, because you recognize that if I had to start over with nothing, there's nowhere to go from that. And I think we can look at the little storefronts in the downtown of Brainerd 50 years ago as being a place you could start with relatively nothing, or a couple blocks away in the margins of the downtown, and say you could get a little shop out here on the edge and work your way up to have the nice shoe store in the center of town. That was a possibility. That is not a possibility today.
Well, and working at those stores was a possibility. I mean, you can't talk about the change in our economy without talking about some of the, you know, cultural changes that have occurred in the workplace since the 1950s. But I just know it from my family's story and from a lot of stories I hear people I know talk to on the Iron Range. When dad or grandpa or whoever it was went out on disability from a mining accident or something, and mom or grandma had to go get some work to just to pay the bills. You know, my own grandmother did that. My grandpa went out on disability after an accident, and my grandma worked at the credit union. You know, it wasn't a high-paying job, but it was a good job that allowed them to pay bills while some income was coming in from disability, but it allowed them to raise six girls, and it created equilibrium. Well, you know, as these smaller institutions in a town, and a lot of, you could hear a story of them working at the Pennies or them working at the shirt factory that used to be there years before that. You know, and these were jobs that played a role in the economy, not necessarily terminal jobs like, oh boy, I sure hope I work there someday.
My grandma worked at Sears.
Yeah.
My other grandma, not the one in the Francis shop, worked at Sears, and it mm-hmm. was, you know, mm-hmm. six kids. It was just a way to mm-hmm. kind of bolster the family income a little bit at times.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, this was a part of this. The other thing I'd say is one of the things we can't overlook in this, and I think your assessment of the left and the right and their approach to this is pretty accurate. You know, one of the things I saw after I wrote that column I talked about earlier is a conservative friend of mine commented online that it was, they didn't adapt and so they failed. You know, which is a libertarian argument, essentially, that while these companies failed, therefore their punishment is death, and something stronger will emerge in their place, which is in a pure form, it sounds kind of great. You know, it sounds like very clear, no ambiguity here. You know, we have a full understanding here. But the truth is, as you point out, it wasn't quite that neat and easy to explain why Herberger's closed, because Herberger's had some other things going on. And the other thing about that is, and this is where a lot on the left would come from, and certainly where I come from, human life doesn't necessarily respond to market forces the way a business might. supply and demand is a very different thing when you're talking about rights, values, and stability in a human being's life. A child who happens to be born to parents who maybe don't make great decisions, you could say, well, they failed. They were born into this horrible situation, and the proper thing, evolutionarily speaking, is to allow them to perish. At least in our economy, perish in terms of not have access to the right education, the right tools, the right connections to move into what Chuck described, which is this elite class that I think all of us here it doesn't feel elite sometimes, but really we're sitting here wearing khaki shorts. I think we're part of the elite, so to speak. Certainly in rural Minnesota, you'd say, so here we are with a radio show. My goodness. These people will never have access to this sort of life because of their hazard of birth. And I just find that, you know, in the discussion of like how central we are, I think we do want to centralize our values. And I don't mean like the whole country has to have the same values, but I think left and right alike would say, you know, we don't want people to suffer. In fact, you know, I'm not trying to be backhanded here. What I'm saying is, you know, I like conservatives a lot better when I'm talking to them about our community.
Sure.
You know, and they like me a lot better when I'm talking about their community. When we're not talking about the political story of the day and we're talking about making sure people have a place to work and a place to buy clothes and a place to the kids have a good education, I think the agreement level is very much high on those things. And it's not a political thing. But when, you know, how do we create these centralized values for our communities where the people who have will acknowledge their role in helping the people who do not? And that's, I think, where the crux of our disagreements come from, too.
I know we're up against the clock. Let me just say real quick, I find the libertarian market argument fascinating because when we look at like, okay, Bonton goes away and something will emerge and take its place, it ignores the fact that like the mall, all the infrastructure for the mall was subsidized by the government.
Yeah.
The highway
and that's
out
exactly
of town
what I said
was
to
subsidized
this guy.
By
yeah.
the government. Mm-hmm. The financial system, the fact that we bailed out every Wall Street bank, that we've driven down interest rates for decades to keep the liquidity flowing through this market to allow this to persist, has all been done by centralized fiat. If you want to actually look at a competitive marketplace, go out in nature and look at a natural ecosystem. It's harsh. It's mean. It's cruel. You go to the downtown Brainerd of 100 years ago, it was a highly competitive, cruel place. People went out of business all the time. But as an ecosystem, it was really strong. That's the difference.
You're listening to Dig Deep. We will continue this conversation about a retail crisis in northern Minnesota in our next segment.
Now I live at my brother's.